From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, an unusually candid conversation about race in the writer's room. We'll talk to a white writer about her experiences working on a black sitcom. Then we'll examine some of the issues raised by that conversation under the microscope of a new diversity report from the Writers Guild West. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. No, it's not your agent calling. It's The Business from NPR. Listen carefully, Grasshopper. We begin the caravan with a Hollywood koan. If you have the rights to make a Terminator film, but you don't have Arnold Schwarzenegger or James Cameron, what do you have? The Halcyon Company is betting that the answer is a new Terminator franchise. Halcyon is a privately funded company recently formed by entrepreneurs Victor Kubasek and Derek Anderson. They acquired the rights to produce new Terminator films last week. What Kubasek and Anderson do have is a script by T3 writers John Brancato and Michael Ferris, and the hope of releasing Terminator 4 in the summer of 2009. Who will fill the shoes of director Cameron and star Schwarzenegger? One would have to travel to the future and then back again to the present to know. And if you think I'm willing to wake up naked in the middle of L.A. again to find out, you're wrong. Meanwhile, as science fiction is heating up, science fact has Rupert Murdoch seeing green? Yes, the idea of the world's most conservative media mogul aligning himself with Al Gore sounds a little bit like a joke. But Murdoch did just that last week, promising to take his entire media behemoth green. He stunned newspaper readers in Australia and around the world with the announcement that News Corp intends to slash its global carbon footprint to zero. It could be difficult. News Corporation produced over 640,000 metric tons of greenhouse gas last year, and easily half of that hot air came directly from Bill O'Reilly. While Roop is worrying about global warming, the TV world is fretting over the loss of its audience. The AP's David Bowder reported last week that TV is having its worst spring in recent memory. 2.5 million fewer people have been watching the Big Four broadcast TV networks compared with the same time last year. Whether this is because of too many reruns, early daylight savings time, lousy shows, or proliferating TiVos is anyone's guess. But that last one is really terrifying the networks. Millions of people are now making their own television schedules, and the industry simply isn't equipped to keep track of them. With the TV advertising season kicking off this week, we have a message for the networks. Good luck hanging on to the nearly $8.8 billion you raked in this time last year. Finally, some truly surreal news from the Middle East. It's not every day that a beloved Disney character is hijacked into being the spokesman for a group of terrorists. The Palestinian group Hamas had been airing a TV program that featured a Mickey Mouse lookalike urging Palestinian children to fight Israel and work towards global Islamic domination. Then, last week, Hamas Information Minister Mustafa Barghouti backed down, saying the character was, quote, a mistaken approach. We're just guessing here, but no doubt Hamas got a letter from Disney and, justifiably, panicked. Never mind the Jews in the West Bank. It's the lawyers in Burbank you really need to fear. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Later in the show, TV's been in full color for half a century, but the writer's room is still mostly all white. But next, an Irish Catholic girl from Boston gets a job writing for a black sitcom. Hey, that sounds like a good idea for a show. It's no big secret that whatever the color of the character speaking on your TV, it's probably a white writer who put the words in their mouth. We'll look more closely at that a little later in the show, but first, a spin on that familiar scenario. Julie Bean is a white girl from Boston who was hired to write on The Game, a black sitcom that airs on the CW.
Can you believe these people treat me this way?
Tasha, calm down. Does it really matter if you get your coffee 30 seconds later?
Yes, it does. I'm spending money in here just like he is, and I deserve some respect. And if you give him that latte before I get mine, I'm going to set it off up in here.
Julie's personal and professional trepidations about working on The Game and the experience she actually had say a lot about race and show business. Julie Bean, welcome to the business.
Thank you very much.
Let's talk about your most recent gig and the one you may be, please God, going back to.
Yes, your lips to God's ears.
You were a writer and now story editor on a program called The Game,
yes.
Which is a scripted.
It's a scripted half-hour multi-camera comedy for the CW.
Okay.
You know, one of the few multi-camera shows on now. Everything's single camera.
So when we say multi-camera, what we really mean is sitcom.
Sitcom. Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
And in particular, this sitcom is...
It's an... technically, it's called an urban sitcom. That's the PC name for it, which means it's a black sitcom.
So when it came up that this show, The Game...
Yeah.
...is a quote-unquote black show...
Yeah.
...what did you think? What are the ramifications of working on a black show for you as a writer?
Well, being an Irish Catholic girl from Boston, I was sort of like, huh, doesn't that make me inherently racist in a way? I was worried because working in television, first of all, there are few and far between of black people that you work with. You know, there's not a lot of people that black people that you come across. I mean, I think the first 4 or 5 shows, reality included and scripted, that I've worked on, maybe one black person per show. So I was a little worried about that. Like, am I going to get along with – is it weird? Am I going to be like this weird, you know, token hire? Is it going to be strange? But it was – and I was very, very, very nervous about it because I did want to make a good impression. And also I wanted to be able to write for a show in a voice that was sincere. Does that – if that makes sense? Like, I wanted to – because when you pitch a joke, if I'm going to pitch a joke for the business, I'm going to pitch it in Claude Bordesser's voice. I'm going
to
pitch a joke.
Which is to say decidedly unfunny.
Super unfunny, which is great. So when you get on the show, you don't – it was – you know, that was my biggest fear, was how do I pitch for these characters without – you know, in the voice that isn't my voice. And what I learned is you don't. That was the first thing that I learned, is that you don't. And so I sort of like was great. I was like had a great assist record on the show. I would pitch it. And then my friend Kenya Barris, who's like the joke king in the room, I would sort of pitch it, look at him, and then he makes it sound right for the show.
So they would black up.
You know, when I would write my script, this is actually I will admit it because it is the right thing to do. I would write it. And then I would send this Jamie Turner, who's a writer's assistant there, who's also, you know, trying to break into the business. I would send him and I'd be like, could you spin some black gold on this? Because I knew when I would go sit down to the table read, it wouldn't be funny. Like I just couldn't sort of make that translation. And he would give me options and I would plug his options into the lines I had written. There was one where somebody was texting. They were texting back and forth. And I wanted him to be like, you know, oh, you naughty girl, sort of thing. Like, and of course, that's the whitest thing in the world. Like, oh, you naughty girl, look at what you texted me. So I sent that to Jamie. I'm like, could you make this sound right? And he wrote back, so that's how you do. Yeah, so that's how you do. And I would never in a million years know how to write that. The reaction to it is great. Like that is it's a great line.
It kills.
It's flavor. It kills. It's character. Everything about it is on the money. And it's, you know, a writer's assistant who just can do it and give it to me in a heartbeat.
Staffing season happens. Mm-hmm. And this show was a whole cloth creation, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So there was no sort of reaction time where you're sort of a new guppy dropped into the tank of piranhas or anything.
Right.
Everyone sort of comes to work on that day and discovers who they're working with.
Yes, yeah.
Or does it not work that way? I mean, is there such a network of closely related writers that everybody knows who they're going to be writing with and knows them by reputation, if not by association?
Let me explain, like, to me, what I learned is that, you know, you think, well, there's sitcom writing and there's drama writing, you know, and those are the two different kinds. And then there's reality show. And these are all sections. What I learned is that, you know, urban sitcoms, black sitcoms is also its own subsection. There are people that had worked together before on shows I had never heard of. So people there knew each other from other shows, but I didn't know anybody there. So I was sort of dropped into the situation where I didn't know, will I be the one white girl? Will I be, you know, the only white girl? Will I be one of two? One of three? You know, you just you there was no way of knowing. And you get a list, like the showrunner sends you, here are the people you're working with. And I look these names up and I start checking on the shows that they work on, you know, IMDb, everybody, like everybody does. And I'm like, okay, all right, well, they worked on Frasier. I know there was only one guy, black guy, that worked on Frasier the whole time it was on. So, okay, that's not them. So they're white. And then I would go down the list, and then people worked on shows like called One on One, which was on for a lot of years, shows called Cuts, the Jamie Foxx show. I mean, all these shows that they had all worked together for years on and I never did.
When you walk into that room that first day, what's the reaction? Is it, you know, Everybody Loves Raymond is down the hall?
It was weird, you know. My first day, no one really spoke to me, and I was convinced it was because I was a white chick. I'm like, they're not talking to me. They're not. No one really.
The other writers
really. No one said hello to me, and I was like, well, that's sort of weird. But then I was like, I'm being paranoid. And then a woman who ultimately turned out to be a great friend, she came in late, and she sort of said hi and shook hands to everyone except me. And I was standing right beside her, and I was like, you got to be kidding me. Like, now no one's just not talking to me, you know. And I was convinced.
As the Irish would say, you're starting, are you?
Yeah.
Oh, you're starting, are you?
And then I get my back up. And now I'm like, oh, all right, I can do the cold shoulder too. And then it's just sort of like this standoff where I'm like, I'm not going to say hi first. They're not going to say hi first. What's going to happen? What's going to happen? And finally, I, you know, said to this woman, like, I'm Julie. Like, I was right beside you. And she's like, oh, yeah. Fine. And, you know, it really was. I mean, I trust, because she is my friend now, that it was an oversight. And there was also another guy who worked on the show who's sort of like the second in command, who I've become also great friends with, who did not talk to me for a solid week. I worked there a week. He did not acknowledge my presence. And I was convinced it was a hazing thing. But when they saw that I had sort of worked like a dog for a long time, that's when they realized, oh, you actually, you know.
Did you address it with any of them? I mean, subsequently, down the road, did you say, what was going on that first
week? You know, I said to my friend Kenny, I'm like, you didn't talk to me for a week. And he's like, nah, you're crazy. You're crazy. I'm like, no, you didn't talk to me. And he's like, I didn't know you.
It's fascinating to hear you say all that, because as it turns out, at least in your heart of hearts, you believe that this was just a question of, you know, dogs sort of having to give each other the sniff test and find out whether or not, you know, we can get along, rather than a race issue.
Right.
And I'm curious, having, as you have, worked on quote-unquote, you know, white shows or
right.
mainstream shows,
right.
Were an African-American writer to come into the room, you know, would he meet the same reaction?
That's an interesting question. You know, it's hard for me to put myself in somebody's shoes like that, because I'm not sure. I can't imagine, but I – you know what? Here's the thing, and I think it came down to this, and I think I was really scared to go in there, quite frankly. I was really worried and, you know, worried I was going to say something wrong. So whether it was that or not, and my friends can joke with me now being like, you're crazy, you know, maybe it was and maybe it wasn't, and I was very, very paranoid about it. But I think in any writer's room, the competition is fierce. You know what I mean? Like, you feel that with other women in a writer's room. Men, I assume, feel it. But you definitely, you know, you got to feel out the hierarchy. And maybe this was just a situation where, you know, I've been on a lot of shows and I've always been, like, you know, the only girl in a room or the only girl in the production. Like, you know, it's been sort of queen bee. And here I was coming to a situation. And I had queen bees in that room who, you know, had earned their keep in a way. And they needed to know where I fit in. And I think it may be a little more competitive in a world where production people, writers, everybody that works in the urban sitcom world, there are fewer and fewer and fewer jobs. You know, if you think about it, however many years ago, there was, you know, there's WB, there's UPN, there's a ton of different sitcoms on, ton of shows that everybody, the whole Paramount lot was all urban sitcoms. And now there's one very fairly watched, you know, network with just one night. And I think that comes out in a room where people need to know, like, are you here because you want to do this and you want to do a good job? Are you just here because you were higher? You were just an easy hire.
Is there any stigma to writing for a black show when you want to go out and get the next job?
I think so. I do, and I don't, you know, I would say I'd feel bad saying that, but it's definitely something we've discussed in the room. And going out this year, I've thought about it because, you know, if the game comes back, which I think it will, because I think it did okay, and I think there's part of me that thinks, well, this is great. I can come back, and I can come back with these people who I've made great friends with. I got this great room. But then I think, well, 1 year on a black show was, you know, it was a great experience. Just 2 years on a black show make me a white girl that can only write for black shows? And I think that is a real thing that I have to worry about, because I know, you know, I have friends on the show who have white friends who have had a hard time getting jobs after working at, you know, only UPN shows or only WB shows and stuff like that. So I don't know. I don't think any studio executives would, you know, or any production companies would say that. But I do think, yeah, it's a subsection in the way daytime TV is a subsection, and maybe they're not giving it the consideration that they should.
Do writers who are black and write for black shows aspire to sort of breaking out of that subgenre and writing for, you know, The Office or some other such show? Or is that just sort of some – is that seen as selling out? Is that seen as transgressing? Is it something crazy? Or
I think that is a very – that's very personal to each writer question. I think there are some writers I can think of who are in the room who would love to get on – I mean, people just want to get on a hit show. I mean, that is it. That's the holy grail. And unfortunately, unless there's a star attached, you know, Bernie Mac or Chris Rock or Bill Cosby, you know, like these shows don't become, you know, cross-cultural hit shows. So I think that, you know, there are some people that would really love to break out and be on a hit show because, I mean, it just does – it does wonders for your development and all this other stuff. But then I know of, you know, I definitely know of one writer on the show who has had offers on, you know, white show, I guess. I don't know what you would call it, like a mainstream show, and has chosen to stay in urban sitcoms because that's important to him. That's an important place. That's an important market to feed. And I respect that. But I also think, like, that's a hard line to toe. That's because every year they're just chopping and chopping and chopping these shows. And it's like, he's an excellent writer, and it's like, you know, you want him to say, just do everything. Just do everything, because what happens if all these shows go away, you know, and it all could.
Julie Bean is a writer on The Game, which, please God, comes back.
Yes, yes,
on the
yes.
CW. Julie Bean, thanks for being on The Business.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Mix one part economic necessity, one part good intentions, one part old-fashioned prejudice, and about 1,000 parts liberal guilt, and you get Hollywood's recipe for dealing with issues of race, both in front of and behind the camera. In a recent episode, the NBC sitcom 30 Rock highlights the clumsy way people deal with race in show business. In this scene, a black TV writer objects to a black actor performing a sketch in drag.
What's your problem?
I just think it's demeaning for a black man to do drag.
What? Everybody loves a dude in a dress. I mean, those are the best Bugs Bunnies.
Frank, there are large pockets of African-American culture that Caucasians know nothing about. The stigma of drag is one of them.
Whatever. I played a woman before. Hunky Grandma Be Trippin' made $96 million.
All I'm saying is drag is a way for Caucasians to emasculate you and make you seem non-threatening. We never would have stooped so low on Black Frasier.
Black Frasier? I never heard of Black Frasier.
What? It was huge on BET every Thursday night at about 9 or 9:15.
Coming up after a short break, the Writers Guild exposes familiar truths about who's in the writer's room and what it means for Hollywood and its audience. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. A couple of years ago, a guy named Tyler Perry showed up in Hollywood trying to find a home for a movie built around a character he'd developed on stage. But none of the suits seemed to get why anyone would want to see a movie starring a quote-unquote unknown black man in a dress. Never mind that African Americans had been flocking to theaters for years to see Perry perform as the big-mouthed grandma, Madea. Two movies and millions of dollars later, Tyler Perry is one of the most powerful black figures in show business, though he's doing it all outside the Hollywood system that turned him away. You'd like to think that Hollywood might have learned a lesson from that experience, but according to a new report from the Writers Guild of America West, things are not improving, at least not in the writer's room. Darnell Hunt is author of the 2007 Hollywood Writers Report, Whose Stories Are We Telling? He's director of the Ralph J. Bunche Center for African American Studies at UCLA. Kim Myers is a TV producer and the newly appointed director of diversity at the Writers Guild West. The business producer, Matt Holzman, spoke with them both about the report and what it means.
Professor Darnell Hunt, Kim Myers, welcome to the business.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming down. So let's start with you, Professor Hunt, and just get kind of the executive summary of the findings of the report.
Sure. I mean, to really sort of sum things up, there's been very little progress for writers of color and for women writers. Just to kind of walk through some of the headlines, I guess, for women overall, employment's been flat over the last few years. In fact, right now, women writers remain underrepresented about 2-to-1 among writers in the industry. For minorities, there's been a decline in television since the last report that came out about 2 years ago, even though minorities make up about 32 or so percent of the population. Right now, they comprise only about 9% of writers writing in television, which leads to an underrepresentation of about 3-to-1. Minority employment has been flat in film since 1999. There's been no progress in over 7 years. They're stuck at about 6% right now, which leads to about a 5-to-1 underrepresentation. The earnings gaps between minorities and white male writers is the highest it's been in 15 years, about $35,000 right now. The gender gap is also pretty large, about $25,000. In fact, women writers have never equaled male writers in terms of what they earn. So it's a pretty bleak picture, and I think one of the conclusions of the report is that business as usual is just not working, and we need to figure out what else we can do.
You have a theory about why things aren't getting better there?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there are a number of things going on. In the political realm in our society, there is this official pronouncement that somehow or another we're beyond race and race doesn't matter. The other issue is, I think, the nature of the industry. We have an industry that's very insular. It's an industry that's based on personal networks and relationships. And, you know, if you can imagine an industry where the involvement of people of color and women has been not that great in the past, if it's based on these relationships and networks and you're basically hiring your friends and buddies and people who gave you a break in the past, it becomes very hard for minorities and women to break into that cycle and become a part of the networks that get you a job. So you have a lot of, I think, well-intentioned people who are just trying to stay alive in terms of producing shows, and without other types of incentives and, I guess, encouragement, business as usual just sets in, and you don't give these people a shot. So we see the same numbers over and over again.
I think there's another aspect of the industry. Can I talk to that just
sure.
for a second?
Yeah.
That has to deal specifically with writers. And that is that we are in a time where the number of shows, scripted shows on television is actually decreasing. Therefore, the number of jobs for writers who are members of the Writers Guild are decreasing. So who are the first people to sort of fall out of the system? They tend to be the women and the people of color.
But aside from this being an issue of jobs and of discrimination, what is the problem for the country?
Why do we need these writers writing?
Right.
Simply because it's our belief at the Writers Guild that if you do not have writers from diverse backgrounds who are employed and actually therefore able to tell the stories they want to tell, that you're not going to reflect the reality of what's going on in the country at large on TV and in film. In other words, yes, does it take a writer of diversity to write a diverse story? In our opinion, to a certain extent, the answer is yes.
All right, but let's flip that on you. I'm a black showrunner or a black show creator, and in the reverse of what Professor Hunt was talking about, and in order to be able to tell these stories authentically, I've hired black writers to put words in the mouth of my black characters.
Sure.
Do those showrunners, though, rob themselves in some degree by not just saying, I will hire the best writers possible, be they black or white.
I think that's true. And I think you would actually find that on most, you know, black shows, there actually are also white writers. However, the reverse is not true.
It's not true. That is true.
That is what you will consistently find. The data shows that.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just going to add, I mean, the whole idea of the best writer. I mean, what does that mean? We have to interrogate that notion. And so there are lots of writers out there with talent who never get a chance to show that they're among the best writers because they aren't hired.
The statistics in this report show us that 40% of all television shows did not employ even one minority writer. 40% of all the shows on the air. That's a big number.
What are some of the things that the Writers Guild have tried in the past in order to rectify this problem of underrepresentation of minorities and women in the writers' room that haven't worked? What are some of the things that you're going to try now that you hope will work?
Well,
this is okay.
The Writers Guild has collaborated with all of the networks on so-called diversity writing programs. And these are entry-level programs. These are programs that are not run by the Writers Guild, that are run by the networks, and they vary slightly at each network. And we've collaborated on them. We've worked with them through the process of creating these programs, and this was before my time at the Writers Guild, by the way. But each of those programs has had a certain level of success in getting diverse writers entry-level jobs in the system. And there are some people who have moved beyond those entry-level jobs after they did go through whatever was the diversity program that led to a first job on a show. However, the numbers are showing us that the entry-level diversity programs are not making the kind of impact that needs to be made on the industry. So something more has to be done. Now, what those programs will be, I do not exactly know, but it's something that we are going to be working on over the course of, let's say, the next 6 months. Mm-hmm. If you invite us back in 6 months, I hope I'll have some more answers for you, because really I've come into this job literally a month ago as the director of diversity at the Writers Guild, and we know we have to revamp the programs. Whether we create our own programs, which I believe we need to do, and I believe it does have to do something with mentoring between older established writers, bringing these other writers along and letting them into their writing rooms, you know, the writer taking upon themselves to help with this problem. But we also have to do something different with the networks, because the entry-level diversity training writing programs are not enough.
Well, I hope in 6 months when we talk to you that you'll have good things to report, and even as much in the name of better television than in the name of social justice. But we will talk to you again, and thank you for coming down. The study was sponsored by the Writers Guild West. It's called the 2007 Hollywood Writers Report. The subtitle is Whose Story Are We Telling? Darnell Hunt is a director of the Ralph J. Bunche Center for African American Studies at UCLA. He's the author of the report, and Kim Myers is a TV producer and the newly appointed director of diversity at the Writers Guild. Darnell, Kim, thank you so much for coming down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A postscript, the UPN and the WB were both home to many African-American-themed TV shows. Many black writers have lost their jobs as a result of the merger of the two networks into the CW last year. These layoffs will probably be reflected in next year's writer's report. And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Thanks to Darby Maloney for production help. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Rodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.